Pat. Avinoam Pat is the Philip D. Feldman Professor of Modern Jewish History at the Maurice Greenberg Center for Judaic Studies at the University of Hartford, and director of the Museum of Jewish Civilization. He received his PhD in Modern European History and Hebrew and Judaic Studies from the New York University. His first book, Finding Home and Homeland, Jewish Youth and Zionism in the Aftermath of the Holocaust, published 2009, examines the appeal of Zionism for young survivors in Europe in the aftermath of the Holocaust and their role in the creation of the State of Israel. Pat is also the co-editor, together with Michael Berkowitz, of a collected volume on Jewish displaced persons titled We Are Here, New Approaches to the Study of Jewish Displaced Persons in Postwar Germany, and co-author of the source volume entitled Jewish Response to Persecution 1938-1940, published in September 11. He has also published numerous articles, book chapters, and encyclopedia articles on various topics related to Jewish life and culture before, during, and after the Holocaust, and is director of the In Our Words interview project with the children and grandchildren of Holocaust survivors. Avinoam, you're very much welcome.
Thank you. I'll just open to the page, that's fine. Okay. See my family. There we go. Okay, perfect. Yes, see my family and children. So thank you. Thank you for the introduction, and thank you to the organizers for inviting me to be here today, to Evita, to Father Cyril, and everyone who's responsible for putting this extraordinary gathering together. It's really, as a historian who has written about this place and researched its figures in the archives and studied documents, photos, and films about this place and what transpired here and in this region between 1945 and 1948, I have to say that being here for this conference is really a thrill. It's one of the most thrilling experiences, so thank you for organizing. When I was contacted by the organizers, I proposed to speak on the relationship between Rabbi Abraham Klausner and Dr. Zalman Grinberg, who, as you've heard, worked together to develop the Central Committee of Liberated Jews, and their central role in helping develop a unified political voice for the Sheri Kapleta, the surviving remnant, a voice that would express a unanimous Zionist conclusion for the survivors, which, as I've argued elsewhere, played no small part in diplomatic discussions that would lead to the eventual creation of the State of Israel. And I'll still address this topic, but what I did not know at the time was that this invitation would facilitate one of those small world coincidences that make this kind of work truly remarkable. And thanks to this conference, I discovered that Zalman Grinberg's son, Yair, lives in Connecticut, not far from me. And Connecticut is a small state, so it's not hard to find other people in Connecticut, but I'd been working on this for a long time, and it was a remarkable coincidence to find that Zalman's son lives in Connecticut. And Yair shared some of his father's materials with me and sat for an interview as well, and I also had the pleasure of speaking with Emanuela before this conference, who's also here writing a family history. And what these personal encounters reinforced for me is that the image of individuals that we're able to construct from archival documents, from letters, memoirs, testimonies, and photographs is, of course, never complete. And what's hardest to reconstruct is the nature of human interactions in the moment between two individuals. Interactions that can have an impact that will last many lifetimes. The unique personal relationship that developed between Abraham Klausner and Zalman Grinberg in the year that they worked together after liberation, one where they managed to establish a deeply personal and tight bond that would impact each of them for the rest of their lives, This is something that we often miss sifting through the archives, especially when we look at this period in which the Jewish displaced persons after the war felt very much alone and abandoned by the world and resolved to help themselves, and in this process developed a vocal and independent streak that manifested itself in a strong embrace of Zionism as the only solution to their stateless condition. And yet, in this period after the war, there were certain Jews from the outside world, like Abe Klausner, who proved their dedication to the surviving remnant and came to be accepted, in the case of Rabbi Klausner, as, quote, an honorary DP. The survivors themselves came to see Klausner as their most trusted advocate, referring to him as our chaplain, and unlike any other Jew from the outside world, as, quote, one of us, which is really remarkable if we think about the time period. As he worked tirelessly for the liberated, Klausner's zealous Zionist advocacy helped to link the DP problem to the political situation in Palestine. Yet by 1948, his own Zionist passion, he worried, seemed to outpace that of most of the survivors. In some ways, it seems that Klausner played a prominent role as both an outsider and an insider in helping survivors to develop the ability to advocate for themselves before military authorities and world Jewry. In the course of his 3 years in the DP camps, we can also see the shifting nature of the surviving population. That is, the survivors that he encountered in late April and May of 1945 and in the summer of 1945 were a very different population from the surviving remnant that lived here in the DP camps. As Adas alluded to, the growth of that population by 1946 and into 1947. It's very crucial that we understand the differences that developed, who was liberated from the concentration camps and who arrived coming from Eastern Europe over the course of 1946 and 47. So let me tell you a little bit about Rabbi Abraham Klausner, and I'm going to deviate a little bit from my remarks because I don't want to repeat some of the things that have been already addressed here, so I'll jump around a little bit, but there are certain things that I think are important for us to address. Here you can see a photo of Abe Klausner, born in Memphis, Tennessee on April 27th, 1915. Klausner was one of five children of Joseph Klausner, an immigrant from Hungary, and Tilly Binstock Klausner, an immigrant from Austria. He graduated from the University of Denver in 1938 and was ordained at Hebrew Union College in 1941. Following ordination, Klausner joined the army and served as a chaplain. He entered Dachau with the 116th Evacuation Hospital in mid-May of 1945, 3 weeks after the camp had been liberated. And he would come to remain in Bavaria for the next year. I'll get into what happened to him in the second half of 46 when he was sent back to the United States. Upon his arrival in Dachau, Klausner helped survivors to bury the dead and to organize bedding and provisions, including kosher food. He was deeply moved by survivors' constant requests for information about family members and for aid in finding them. In a testimony recorded in 1998, Klausner recalled one of his first encounters at Dachau. And I'll quote, "And then a thing happened which changed the course of my life. A voice came from one of the shelves, and it was very thin and it had a cry. And the voice said, I had a brother, and we lived together, and he went to the United States and became a rabbi. Do you know my brother? Strangely enough, Klausner says, I said, yes. Not only do I know your brother, but he is here in Europe and I will bring him to you. I realized I had a purpose. This man who had survived Dachau, his last name was Spiro, and his brother was Avraham Spiro, and his brother Avraham Spiro had also become a chaplain working with the U.S. military forces. And so after he was able to reunite these two brothers, Klausner decided that his mission was to find and bring brothers together. As he later wrote in his memoir, the moment penetrated my soul, telling me I had a purpose in coming to Dachau. If I brought brothers together and nothing more, I would have achieved some small measure of significance in my life." Let me skip ahead here. This is a photo you can see from Liberation of Calvary.
Sorry, this is Camp 4.
This picture?
It's Camp 4.
Okay. So I'll blame the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum caption, which I copied to here. So I'll tell the photo archives. So this, you can see here, Klausner began to compile lists of survivors he met in the camps in Bavaria and to publish them under the series title Chérie Tapleta. Now this term, the name Chérie Tapleta, which means the surviving remnant, or is translated as the surviving remnant, was a name that Klausner took from the writings of the prophets. And as he would later say, he was always had a love affair with the prophets, and he scribbled the name on the title of this first name list that he came up with to say that the prophets had said there would always be a saving remnant to treasure the call of the Lord. While this term had been used before Klausner used it, leaders in the Yishuv used it to refer to what they expected would remain, it's still noteworthy that Klausner used this name, which would come to be identified with the surviving remnant, the surviving population. In the first volume of the Chérie Tapleta series, Klausner included a preface, which was titled Regarding Your Rights. And in this piece, he informed survivors that contrary to the official United Nations policy, the UNRWA policy of the time, they were not obligated to return to their home countries. They were free to make their own decisions about whether to repatriate. And this is very important because if we think of the chaos of the post-war period and an Allied policy of returning people to their home countries, Jews were in a different situation. And so for Klausner to explain, you don't have to follow what they're telling you to do, you have certain rights, this was a very important move. After the 116th Evacuation Hospital was sent to a different location, Klausner returned to Dachau against army orders, telling the commander of the 127th Evacuation Hospital unit at Dachau that he had been reassigned. Eventually, after the 127th also left Dachau, Klausner was assigned to a G5 civil affairs staff section to work in the interests of the DPs. Beyond aiding survivors in their search for lost relatives and pressing American Jewish organizations for aid, Klausner sought early on to convey to the Yishuv the political wishes of the survivors. In the third issue of Chérie Tapleta, he published a letter from the Jewish Agency to the surviving population. That is, Klausner had engaged in a correspondence with the Yishuv in Palestine, with the Jewish Agency, to say, there is a population of survivors here, they want to go to Palestine. And he published the response from the Yishuv, which said, the only wish of the Yishuv is to see gathered in our land the remnant of the House of Israel. And as Ada has explained, Klausner ends up playing an important role in organizing some of these first meetings between soldiers from the Jewish Brigade and representatives of the Jewish Agency and the surviving population. As we've also heard, during the course of his early work in Bavaria, Klausner soon met Dr. Zalman Grinberg, a doctor and survivor from Kovno. And as we've heard, and I'll skip over this, the period of Grinberg's arrival at Saint-Otilien, because we've heard this a few times. Same picture. I'll skip ahead a little bit in the interest of time. We've heard about Grinberg's work to come down and organize Saint-Otilien. Now, while demonstrating striking resourcefulness in the wake of tragedy, the survivors in the region around Munich, that is Dachau, Landsberg, Saint-Otilien, and the surrounding area, were disenchanted with what they saw as the slow arrival of the outside world, and in particular Jewish relief organizations. And the slow arrival gave rise to a sense of abandonment that would remain a central feature of the surviving remnant's constant striving for independence. Grinberg wrote a letter to the World Jewish Congress at the end of May of 1945, and in this letter expressed this disappointment. He wrote, "It has been 4 weeks since our liberation, and no representative of the Jewish world, no representative from any Jewish organization, has come to be with us after the worst tragedy of all time, to speak with us, to give us help, and to lighten our burden. We must ourselves, with our own diminished strength, help ourselves." And we heard this theme also. I'll just skip ahead. Here's some photos of survivors in Saint-Ottilien later, maybe I can come back to this later, we heard this theme also expressed in his speech from May 27th of 1945. This idea that we are free now, but we do not know what to begin with free our free and unhappy life. It seems to us that for the time being, mankind does not comprehend what we have gone through and what we've experienced during this period of time. And it seems to us, neither shall we be understood in the future. So again, you have this disconnect between what the survivors have experienced and the inability of the outside world to comprehend what they've been through, coupled with the sense of abandonment that they've gone through. Discouraged by the continuing absence of assistance from world Jewry, Grinberg and Klausner decided to take matters into their own hands. Assisted by survivors and representatives from the Jewish Brigade, Grinberg and Klausner convened the first meeting of the Central Committee of Liberated Jews in the U.S. known on July 1st, 1945, at Feldafing, near Dachau. The Central Committee's mission was to champion the interests of the Jewish DPs and draw the attention of the U.S. Army and UNRWA to their plight. As Ada has explained, by September of 1946, that is over a year after the Central Committee would first come together, the U.S. Army finally granted them recognition as, quote, the legal and democratic representation of liberated Jews in the American zone. The political organization of the Shelita Plita and what would come to be its largely Zionist leadership would greatly influence the options open to the Jewish population as a whole. The Central Committee focused on immediate needs of survivors, food, shelter, medicine, and security, but also addressed the questions of where survivors should go. There were some who were encouraging them to return to Poland, others encouraging them to return to the European homelands, and still others who emphasized that the only solution was migration to Palestine. As one representative from Lithuania suggested, the lack of involvement on the part of Jews from other parts of the world indicated that, quote, Aliyah, that is immigration to Palestine, to the land of Israel, was the only way to solve the Jewish question. In its resolutions, the committee called for unity among the Jews in the efforts to build a Jewish state and demanded that the British open the gates of Palestine. The Central Committee appointed Abraham Klausner as honorary president and elected Dr. Grinberg as chairman of the executive board. And Klausner would write that he later saw this July 1st meeting as a very important moment for the survivors who until then had been locked away in camps, denied identity, and mobilized physically, socially, and culturally, beginning to take their own affairs into their own hands, resolving to help themselves. Throughout its time in the DP camps, the Central Committee continued to maintain this ardently Zionist position. Now, I think it's important. I'm actually going to take a step for a second because we haven't actually explained sort of the nature of the administrative system that existed here in the DP camp. So I'm going to stop for a second and just explain sort of what we're looking at, which is this is a map of liberated Germany after 1945. And you can see here that Germany was divided into four zones of occupation. And most of the Jewish DP camps would be established in what was the American zone of occupation here, right? So obviously we're here in Bavaria, but this is actually very crucial as a matter of significance. The other zones, the pink zone was the Soviet zone, the green zone was the British zone, and then on the bottom left you can see the purple was a French zone of occupation. Now, this is important because in the initial time period, Jews were not recognized as a separate category of displaced persons. And so even arguing politically for rights of Jews as a separate national group was a very important step in terms of having some recognition that they had their own needs. And so Klausner and Grinberg, working together with this newly formed DP leadership, were striving to improve conditions for the Jews in the displaced persons camps and prevent them from being housed with other DPs from other parts of Europe, right? If people were organized nationally, they could be with Lithuanians, with Poles, with Ukrainians. There were not necessarily separate Jewish DP camps. In fact, the work of Klausner and Grinberg was crucial at alerting authorities in the United States to the conditions that the Jewish DPs were facing after liberation. And in fact, in the summer of 1945, This eventually, what was a campaign to raise awareness of what the DPs were facing, got to President Truman, who dispatched Earl Harrison, an envoy, to the DP camps to assess the situation that the survivors were facing. Harrison, who had been an expert dealing with immigration and refugee affairs, in fact, was the head of the INS in the United States, Immigration Naturalization Service, was an expert. He toured around the DP camps. In fact, Klausner would write that he had a role in making sure that Harrison saw exactly what he needed to see, got hold of his itinerary, changed the itinerary to make sure that that Harrison saw what was actually happening in the DP camps. You can see here, this is a picture from Harrison's visit. He also went to the British zone. And in the end of August, this was published in September of 1945, Harrison published what would come to be a very shocking report that came to be known as the Harrison Report on the plight of the displaced Jews in Europe. Because what Harrison found, and the most famous line from the report, was he found that we, meaning the Americans, continue to treat the Jews as the Nazis treated them. That is, that they are locked in camps behind barbed wire with armed guards. And so this, even in the early period, was of crucial significance, that they get Harrison to see what's happening in the DP camps and change the situation. After the Harrison Report, he recommends Jews to be separated in their own Jewish DP camps, and also to create the position of an advisor for Jewish affairs. And finally, and perhaps most controversially, Harrison says, we can solve the problem of the Jewish DPs very easily, grant them 100,000 certificates for immigration to Palestine, and this will solve the problem once and for all. Of course, it wasn't so simple. The British objected to this solution, and then we have the Anglo-American Committee to study it. But we can see that from this early period of time, the solution of the DP problem becomes associated with a political solution in Palestine. That is, the two are linked. So this early advocacy of a Zionist solution to the DP problem comes to play a crucial role. Now, during this early period in the summer of 1945, Klausner continued to focus on his original goal, continuing to publish lists of names in the Shelite Pleita, and continuing to do his work to bring families together. Now, we've heard some references to very personally what happened with Zalman Grinberg and being able to reunite Zalman with his son, Emmanuel. And Klausner writes about this episode from 1945 in his memoir. And I'm going to quote from his memoir. He writes, "During our last days in the museum, a stranger walked into my cubicle carrying a child he placed upon my desk. I stared at the child and his bearer, each a vision etched in the contrast of youth and age. The stranger did not speak. He drew a paper from his pocket, which I recognized as a page from one of the Shelite Pleita volumes. He unfolded the page and drew my attention to a line which read, Grinberg, Zalman, Doctor, Kaunas, 1912. At the same time, pointing to the child, indicating it was Zalman's. I was overwhelmed. It was the first child to arrive in our liberation zone. I took the child in my hands, stared and spoke, saying things not for him to hear, but for me to say, caught up in a moment that made all others wither away." I'll skip down. When word got out that a child had been brought to me from Lithuania, my cubicle was crowded with the curious, threatening to break apart its precarious walls. With the arrival of Yanka Levin, pandemonium broke loose. "That's my Emmanuel," he cried, half cried and half laughed. I took him out of the ghetto. He turned to talk to the child as if he would remember his escape from the ghetto, and then turned to me unfolding the story. Eventually, Klausner was able to bring Emmanuel up to Saint-Otilien and able to reunite Emmanuel with Zalman Grinberg. "I thought about the moment I would deliver the child to his father. My soul was filled with joy that it had never known. I picked up the child, placed him next to me in my jeep, and off we went, first to stop in Dachau and then on to Saint-Otilien. In the moment, I tried to visualize the return of a child to his father. The child was my metaphor for survival. He was alive, our tomorrows, beautiful and bright. I called him Sakiki. His language was Lithuanian. When I came to visit, Zalman would say to his son, Sakiki Shalom, say Shalom. And then he writes, Sakiki died. There I said it, just plain, he died. And all I can tell you is that in his hour of death, his mother gave birth to another child, and they called him Raphael, God will heal. Now, after August of 1945, Klausner was no longer formally or even informally attached to a military unit. He felt himself, as he described himself, now no more than a DP. I had no assigned military connection and had to devise ways of supporting myself. And indeed, it seems that by this time, Klausner had come to identify himself with the survivors and their plight. In the first issue of, and I'm going to skip ahead, here's photos from some of these first post-war conferences. In the first issue of the DP journal, Unser Weg, Our Way, the Yiddish weekly sponsored by the Central Committee, Klausner penned an article titled, One of You, in which he described the intimate connection he had established with the survivor population. I know you well, my people. I know your thoughts and hear your speech. I know your dreams and I behold your works, and I'm thankful to destiny for weaving me into the pattern of your rebirth. Have I written as one who has suffered with you? I have done it only because I have hoped during these months that if not through suffering, then through my work you would accept me as one of you. The editorial board's response sealed Klausner's special status as an honorary member of the surviving remnant. They wrote, Rabbi, friend, brother, you have become one of us. Others shared the view that not enough was being done to help the Jewish DPs and saw Klausner as the true champion of the survivors. Rabbi Eli Bonin, the first chaplain to reach Dachau after the war, described Klausner as, quote, the one bright gleam of hope in the whole mess. The agencies have done practically nothing, and he has, by himself, moved mountains. If he had the resources of JDC at his disposal, he would have performed super miracles. As it is, he only performed miracles. Klausner dedicated the fourth volume of Shevet HaPleta to Zalman Greenberg. Of him he wrote, and the Lord chose him from among his sorrowing children and said unto him, forget thy sorrow and burden thyself with the afflictions of my children. Wipe the tears from off their cheeks, heal their wounds, and kindle their hearts with hope. And so it was. Now, in the interest of time, and I have a short video that I want to show to us gathered here, I'm going to skip the rest, but I'll just mention that Klausner dedicated himself to helping the survivors in the first year after liberation, and his constant complaining about the lack of assistance that's coming from the outside world, in particular the Joint Distribution Committee, which did play a tremendous role in helping the survivors, it got him in trouble with the Joint. And eventually, he had a major interpersonal conflict with Leo Schwartz, who was the director of the JDC for the American Zone. And Schwartz would later describe, here you can see a picture of Leo Schwartz addressing the Central Committee, and right next to him is Klausner. He would later say that the only efficient thing that he managed to do in his time in the DP camps in Germany was to have Klausner sent back to America. So there was a real conflict going on there. I can discuss it later, but I think part of this is that Klausner was so single-minded in his determination to aid and assist the survivors that he cut through all the red tape. He wasn't worried about burning bridges, and this conflict continued in all sorts of ways. You can see, I mean, Klausner is such a central figure, and I've written an article about this, but he, when Ben-Gurion comes and he's trying to argue to the Yishuv that the survivors really are enthusiastic in their Zionism, you can see here Klausner there, two over on the left, he was sort of appeared everywhere, you know, made sure that he was always in the right place at the right time. Here he is meeting with Major Irving Haymont, who was the head of the Landsberg DP camp. Now what I wanted to do, and I'll be happy to talk about the rest of the period. Klausner ends up coming back to Germany in in January of 47, and he becomes very disenchanted with what he sees as the shift in the nature of the surviving population. He's worried that the Zionism that animated them in the first year after liberation has dissipated, they're becoming impatient, and so he begins to advocate radical solutions. He says, we have to force them to go to Palestine. But in the interest of time, I want to play this video for you to give you a flavor. So, okay, here it is. So, Ada mentioned. There it is. So Ada mentioned this January 46 conference of the Central Committee of Liberated Jews. So there's a video of it. So I'm going to play a little bit of it just so you can see Klausner talking and then Zalman Greenberg talking, and then I'll end with that. And this was part of what we can see as a PR campaign, both by the Central Committee and by Klausner. And clearly, you can see the film is going to be in English. The target audience is an American audience. You have to help the surviving population. The partisan song. Skip ahead so we can see him talking.
How long will homelessness pack the dreams of the suffering children of Israel and fill their hearts with despair? Central Committee of Liberated Jews in Germany is now in conference to discuss these problems common to the people.
Solution in some sense to the stateless condition. I'm going to cut it off there so we have some time for questions. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Evita decided that we have time for two questions. Maybe three. There's
two more. Questions, and I'll give four answers.
Hello. Thank you very much. This conference is amazing. My name is Bert Rochelson. I'm visiting from New York, and I'm here to connect some dots that I'm hopefully somebody in this room can help you with. First, I want to say my father was Eli Rochelson, who was the assistant chief and the chief of the dispensary at the Landsberg Hospital. And I'm here also with my brothers who I've never met before, the brothers Ip and Yair Greenberg. We're all sons of the Kovno physicians, and we're all physicians ourselves, which I think is probably saying something. I want to say one thing quickly about that. These doctors that you're talking about, Greenberg and Ip and Rochelson and Nabriskie, they didn't just save patients, they saved themselves. Because they lost their families, they lost their homes, they lost their relationships, and the only thing that they had left was being a doctor. And I think we have to keep that in mind. They saved themselves. So my father was in the Kovno ghetto, and it's extinguished, and he gets sent to Dachau. And then he is also on the train where the Americans bomb, and he goes off to the woods in Schwabhausen. And I never knew what happened after that, except he went to Landsberg. He didn't go to St. Otilia, and my father was a great historian to us, and I thought he answered all the questions, but he never mentioned St. Otilia. He only mentioned the Landsberg DP Hospital. So I wonder if you or somebody could tell me whether the Landsberg DP Hospital was completely independent from the hospital at St. Otilia, or there was a relationship where people went back and forth. There's so little written about the Landsberg DP camp hospital. So that's my question.
Okay, so I'd say the first answer to that is, as you pointed out, you know, this is a field in terms of DP history and post-war history that's really only developed, I'd say, in the last 20 years or so. And
30
years. Yeah, I guess 10 years ago I could say 20. Yeah. But it's there is a lot more that needs to be researched. What's amazing is that I think that the answers are out there. That is, that there is so much material in terms of the DP Germany collections, in terms of what's at YIVO, at Yad Vashem, that we can start to answer some of these questions. So in the specifics of the case of Landsberg, as we've talked about, it becomes very early on the largest Jewish DP camp. It becomes separated as a separate Jewish DP camp. And you see sort of the early leadership. So we focused to a great extent on St. Otilien, which is very important. We're here and focusing on the early efforts that take place here. But also you see an early leadership arise in Landsberg as well, and arguably sort of the early leadership. So this conference where you have 94 survivors coming together, right? They're coming from a lot of these early DP camps that are created. And so each separate Jewish DP camp had its own administrative apparatus, which I think is really important for us to understand, right? That you have a self-government, the autonomy is really important. The autonomous operation of these camps is created by the Jews themselves. And then this overarching framework that is the Central Committee to represent initially all the liberated Jews in Bavaria, and then it's expanded broadly to cover all of the American zone as a whole. And so that operation becomes very important. So you have leaders in Landsberg, and you have leaders in Feldafing, and eventually in Fehrenwald, and also in St. Otilien, who are leading their camps individually. And I should point out, there are political elections that take place, which is also fascinating too, right? You have people from different political parties running to lead their DP camp, right? So you have, like, in this three-year period of 45 to 48, kind of whatever the political divisions that existed before the war. So when Greenberg is complaining about politics, that you have some people who represent different political parties, you see this beginning to happen in the post-war period, except that all of the political parties, with the exception of Agudas Yisrael, are coming from the Zionist political spectrum. The Bund is complaining that there's nobody representing the Bund. But it's very important that sort of you have people in Landsberg representing these, you know, independent political groups.
Yeah. Okay, there's one more question. I'm
Sorry, you know, the Swiss-German rules here.
Yes.
I was asked by Miss Dumas from the Bayerische Rundfunk, why exactly did the DP camps develop in the American zone and not in the British and the French? It's obvious why not in the Russian.
Yeah. So I think it's important in terms of the context of the time period, in terms of answering it. So we could see this core group that's liberated in the camps here in Bavaria, and this becomes the American zone of occupation. What ends up happening, though, that's really important, and we haven't talked about this, is so Ada alluded to the migration of large numbers of Jews into Germany after 45. And there is sort of this strategic decision that's made because conditions here in the American zone after the Harrison Report resolved to improve conditions for the Jews and create separate Jewish DP camps. There's a realization that the situation is going to be better here in the American zone. The Zionist movement, and when I say Zionist movement, I don't just mean the Jewish agency from the Yishuv, but operatives on the ground in Poland who are organizing the Bricha, the movement of escape, of flight from Poland, also realize that strategically it's going to be very important to funnel people into this zone of occupation so that we end up getting, you know, to about 150,000 by the beginning of 1947, which increases the pressure on the American authorities to come to some sort of diplomatic solution to the stateless condition of the survivors. So I've written about this elsewhere. You see the Americans supporting all kinds of efforts that take place here. I didn't have time to talk about it, but we're on this farm here, which Santa Elena also has a farm, and you have this very unusual phenomenon of kibbutzim that are created all over the American zone, 40 different agricultural training farms for Zionist youth. That doesn't happen without the American authorities saying you could take over this land, and the JDC and UNRWA supporting all these efforts, and these are Zionist training centers. So the American zone is very friendly to the, and they're allowing in the infiltrates. That's another thing. The borders are open to refugees coming from elsewhere. Where in the British zone, it's a very different story, and the British obviously are not supportive. In Belsen, you have this very robust Zionist apparatus there, but you have one camp in the British zone that houses all of the Jewish EPs, and they're not as friendly to the Zionist politics, obviously.
Okay, thank you again, Avinoam and Julia. So we have to rush to get something to eat. We'll go on 3 o'clock, and we'll talk about memory and family history and museums.
Sorry to interrupt again. You're all looking forward to dinner, to lunch. Well, the